The 1994 Salt Lake Sunstone Symposium presents session number 224, the panel discussion, What Might Have Been, What Might Yet Be, The Impact of B.H. Roberts's The Truth, The Way, The Life.
I guess we're supposed to get started. They tell me they have an automatic recording system that records this. And it started 2 or 3 minutes ago. I'm Richard Sherlock, and I'm only the moderator of this. I am not the expert. We have our two other panelists, but they don't have a table up here fit for a panel. Maybe they can join me up here somewhere around the vicinity of where we're supposed to be. And I will let them introduce themselves. You all know them.
I'm Stan Larson. I'm the editor of one of the two editions of The Truth, The Way, The Life.
And I'm Van Hale, and I operate a call-in talk show weekly. I have been since 1980 on Mormon topics.
There you have it. And you were on the news last night. There was a clip from you.
That was someone else.
Presentation of yesterday. The topic of today's discussion is The Truth, The Way, The Life, the masterwork of B.H. Roberts. At least that's the way it's put in Stan's edition. It's a wonderful edition, by the way. Whatever the merits or demerits of the various arguments and the back and forth on that, the edition is really a fine edition. When I was contacted to try and be involved with something on the B.H. Roberts book a couple of months ago, talking about a lot of different things that might be done with respect to this publication, we decided that rehashing the old historical information about how this came to be and then not get published and things, that was already out in various formats, and anybody who was interested in that can go and plumb that research for whatever it's worth. There was some talk about doing a panel comparing the BYU Studies edition and this edition, but that's not a really very fruitful discussion. What differences there are relates to, in a way, editorial differences, and you're always going to have those in scholarly editions of a work which, when Roberts died, was not ready for publication. Like Stan will testify to that. It was not at a point where there were too many marginal notes and there were too many little slips of paper thrown in editions. And editors have to make a judgment about whether or not that fits, whether Roberts was going to revise this passage in light of that or whatever. So that seemed not to be helpful. But the topic that seemed to be most helpful was the question of whether or not, had this book been published the way Roberts wanted it to, there would have been marked difference. It would have had an impact in the Mormon community. And so that is our topic today. What is the import of this book? Will it have an impact now? Would it have had an impact had it been published at some point in Roberts' lifetime? And as moderator, I'll just pose a provocative thing to get us going, and then you all can join me and we'll take lots of questions from the audience. I honestly doubt whether it would have had any kind of an impact at all. And I say that for two reasons. One was that most, if not all, of the key theological points made here are already found either in Roberts' work previous to this, the outline of the 70s course of theology, works on Joseph Smith, New Witnesses for Christ. All of that material was already available. Whatever impact some of those ideas were going to have, it was already possible to have the same kind of an impact. Furthermore, there was a lot of really interesting intellectual discussion in 19th century Mormonism that was already out there and in the public record. I mean, some of it, Orson Pratt obviously had been disciplined or at least heavily criticized by others in the Brethren for some of his speculative work, but there was lots of other material. One looks at Peter Crowley's edition of Parley P. Pratt's material to see what was already available. Much of that was already out. Much of Robert's own thinking was already out in other forms, in forms officially published by the Church and sanctioned by the Church, 70s Manual in Theology. So for that reason, I doubt whether this would have had the kind of an impact that it would have had if it had been published. Secondly, that stuff is already all out there, and I still doubt whether it has had or ought to have the kind of effect that some people would have wished it to have and still wish it would have. And this conclusion that I'm presenting is that it seems to me that Mormonism, one of the key defining characteristics of it, is its ward system of lay leadership, in which, in a way, the lived experience of those communities is in effect the essence of the Church, the lived experience of those wards. And I think I could probably count on my hand the number of times which in any serious discussion in any of the venues of those wards, this kind of material has been referred to. We are not, in a way, a people devoted to high theology. We are devoted to the lived experience of community. I would argue that the most perceptive single essay in Mormon studies in the last 20 or 25 years was Gene England's piece given at Sunstone some years ago, Why the Church is as True as the Gospel. And in a way, for Mormons, the Church is truer than this kind of high theology. I would suggest that for Mormons, the great aphorism is not the aphorisms that Roberts draws from, but the Pascalian aphorism about reasons of the heart. And if that is something close to the essence of Mormonism, if indeed the essence of Mormonism is fast and testimony meeting, then I wonder whether or not this book or any book like this would have any kind of lasting impact, save for a few and interested. But as far as having a lasting impact on the community at large, the way, for example, Catholic theologians had an impact on Vatican II, I doubt whether it ever would. And frankly, I'm not even sure that it should. So I'll leave it.
Thank you. This is if this is a fast and testimony meeting, we probably ought to finish quickly. I don't really have too much to say in that category. I think that there are some things that we should discuss here, and I hope, as you might already know, and if you don't know, you'll soon see, we don't have anything prepared. We're just speaking to you, and so please raise your hand, interject questions whenever you want. We want to finish at the right time, and we hope that there's a dialogue between us this morning. But I do have a couple things I'd like to say in preface. First of all, I'm not sure that everyone here knows about what's happened since last year. Now, last year, I was here at Sunstone and presented a paper on what was called the controversy of the writing of the B.H. Roberts' Truth, the Way to Life. I don't want to go over that again, but I think that in fairness to those that may not be up to date on exactly what's happened, I'll at least summarize this last year, which has been very eventful, and I'm not going to take too long to summarize the whole year, so don't get too worried. But last August, I spoke here, and then the next month in September, I was talking. I give credit to Rick Turley at the Historical Department of the Church for being as open as he was with me. I was talking to him about what I was doing, and he mentioned to me and said, you know, someone else is working on the Truth, the Way, the Life. In last August, I was talking about the controversy and also pointed out that I was in the process and had been for some time editing an edition of this text. So Rick Turley told me someone else is working on it. It happens that we take the same bus, number 47 Express, to West Jordan, and we were sitting together on the bus that night, and he mentioned that, and I said, well, who is it? And he said, well, I couldn't tell you, and, which is quite right. And I thought over the night how I could find out if this was just a statement or whether it really did occur. And I thought, well, now, it's quite right. I work at the Marriott Library and manuscripts. If someone comes in and says, who else is working on this project? Well, confidentiality requires us to say, to not disclose. But it is quite proper if someone came to the library and said, if you know anyone that's working on this topic, would you get in touch with them so that we might be able to work together or compare notes? And so that's essentially what I did. The next day, I called him at the historical department and said, reviewed what I just said now, and said, would you please get in touch with whoever this is and just tell them that I would like to talk to them about this? Well, that afternoon, I got a call from Jack Welch down at BYU Studies. He was the one that has been doing this. So again, this was in September, a month or a few weeks after the Sunstone Symposium. And I made an appointment and went down to see Jack Welch. That was late in the month of September, to try to work out something where we could coordinate and get together on it. As it turned out, he, for whatever reasons, he chose not to have me involved in their edition, the BYU Studies edition of the Book of Mormon. One of the things that he did make very clear is the chronology of when he got involved. And that was, Sunstone was last August, last May of 1993. I had been sending out letters to various descendants of the B.H. Roberts, in the B.H. Roberts family, for permission. Some of those did not respond, but got in touch with Truman Madsen, who got in touch with Jack Welch. So that was in May, and then they decided to do this on their own. So to summarize what's happened, I think personally, and everything I say here is my personal opinion, but I think it's ridiculous and silly that we should have two editions of this text of B.H. Roberts that was, for 60 years after his death, lay unpublished. But we do. So let's accept that. And I think that on the positive side, since there are two editions, it is appropriate that they both came out and were published the very same day in May at the Mormon History Association in Park City. So that's a nice thing, and I think B.H. Roberts would be pleased that there has been this much interest. I'm a little bit surprised, actually, that there is as much interest as this in his work. I would like to say one thing about the effect of this, and that is that we would never have had either one of the two editions if something very significant hadn't happened. Because there was only one manuscript. There were two earlier drafts, but one final manuscript. Final as much as it ever came to be. As is pointed out, there was a number of places where typos were still in there that hadn't been corrected, and notes in the margin that sometimes may be difficult to know exactly where to put and so forth. But anyway, if something hadn't happened, that manuscript, and remember, all three of these drafts are at the church archives. What happened, very significantly, is that a member of the First Presidency got involved in this potential problem. And this was Hubie Brown, first counselor under David O. McKay. And essentially, we don't have in the church what's called an acting president, but that's essentially what he was in from about 1965 to 70, where David O. McKay's health had deteriorated and he didn't really function. So Hubie Brown, on his own authority as a member of the First Presidency, went over to the church archives and got that manuscript 3, the final version available, and took it. I'm not sure where he took it, but he made a copy of it. Then he put the original back, and that's where it still exists today. But that copy, he felt, as he made it, he gave it to his grandson, who is a professor of law at the University of Utah, Edwin B. Firmage, and told his grandson, he said, I'm afraid that something will happen to this manuscript of B.H. Roberts, and he loved him very much, had been on the pulpit with him, speaking with him, and had looked to him for a number of things. And he knew also that Joseph Fielding Smith, who was next in line to be president of the church at the death of David O. McKay, he felt would destroy it or do something to it. So he made this as a kind of a security copy and gave it to his grandson with a commission to guard it and protect it. And he did for almost 30 years. And then finally he donated it to the University of Utah Marriott Library. And that's how we now have this other this other text of the manuscript being published, because it wouldn't have been otherwise. You can't publish a text if you only have a few chapters, and that's all that was available before that. Now, are there any questions up to this point in terms of reviewing the history of it? Yes, let's go ahead.
Are you suggesting then that the BYU study would not have published it if, in fact, the University of Utah had not had a
Well, let me say, first of all, I don't know what would or wouldn't have happened if something didn't occur, but I have a very strong suspicion, especially when Jack Welch, sure. I mean, we're friends, we just happen to be on opposite sides of the theological spectrum, but he said to me, he had several times before applied and written to the church for permission, and those requests were denied. And I think that it's more than coincidental that after it is publicly known, this was not a private thing done in a corner, it was announced not just at Sunstone last year, but also at the B.H. Roberts Society, which we got the manuscript at the library in January of 1992, and I think it was the next month or maybe 2 months later it was announced at a B.H. Roberts Society symposium that was to be the case. So I think it's more than coincidental that when it's aware that an edition of this text is imminently to appear within the next, it turned out, about a year, but it was near completion that they got approval. I don't know. I mean, who knows? But it seems like that's more than coincidence. Yes.
Have you checked their edition versus yours?
Well, I'll answer that, but I really shouldn't be answering that. What we had in Sunstone, the people involved in setting this up, made contact. I assume, no one seems to know for sure, but the idea was, and certainly this was expressed to the people at Sunstone, they were to request Jack Welch or one of the other people, they have about 10, 12 essayists in their edition, to be here so that you could ask a question on both sides and get a balanced view. So I can't answer that in, what I say to people is, every one of you, when you go to the bookstore, Deseret Book or Sam Weller's or Benchmark or wherever you see them, or even your selection, too. Yes, I saw the little note. Wherever they are, look at both editions. The BYU Studies edition has a green cover. Ours has a dust jacket. Here it is here. And I tell people, get them both. Look at them. Pick a chapter and say, okay, chapter 30, 31. Compare the two. Look at them. See what they're like. That's what I tell people to do. But I would like to say something specific on what your question is about the two editions, and that is that you would think, first of all, since these two editors, that there would be a lot. The two editors made judgments on their own, and yet it's amazing how much there's the same. Well, obviously the answer is not because of any insight on the editor's part, either one of them, but the fact that the text is there, and that's what we're trying to follow. So the difficulty or the difference is where you come out with two editions and there's something that's in one and not in the other. Now, what I'd like to point out, and people have said this to me, so I don't really like to be in this position, but you've asked me, so I'll go ahead and tell you. Other people have told me this, so I'm sort of reporting what they said. What they liked about the Smith Research Associates edition, it's distributed by Signature Books, is in the appendix, it has 55 chapters, and each one of those was intended to be a lesson in priesthood for the 70s or maybe for the whole Melchizedek priesthood. At the end of that, what we did, and this was not part of his text, it was an appendix in which all the letters that B.H. Roberts wrote to the general authorities and they wrote back, and their list of objections, three different versions as it went through the committees and so forth, all of those letters and things are printed in toto in the appendix. Now, I quote from them, I quote a little nip here, and Jack Welch quotes a snippet there and so forth, but that's not the same as being able to have all of that correspondence in one thing. So it's a valuable addition there. The other thing I'll just briefly mention, this chapter 31, I didn't just pick out of those 55 randomly. Chapter 31 is, in fact, the most important chapter. It's called an Adamic dispensation, and that's where Beach Roberts talks about the pre-Adamites and got into trouble for suggesting that as a solution to the problem. You would think that it would be the same, but in that particular chapter, the Smith Research Associates edition has an extra 4 pages of text that are not in the BYU Studies edition. We have a little footnote explaining where the text came from, and that B.H. Roberts himself had a typewritten and a handwritten notes to insert it at this point in the manuscript. Actually, it's a very interesting thing. I won't read it. You can go look at it and see it yourself. It talks about referring to quotations from Joseph Smith that relate to Jesus' father and Jesus' grandfather. So you get some interesting ideas and how those relate to Mormon doctrine. The other thing about chapter 31 is at the end of their edition, their edition of that chapter, they have inserted about 6 or 7 pages of TypeScript stuff. I don't know how, maybe it's about 7 or so in their text, that I don't think is a part of chapter 31. That's a decision or an editorial opinion on my part. It certainly was part of B.H. Roberts' presentation to the brethren to get approval, but it could have been in a footnote or an appendix, but shouldn't have been in the text. He never intended it to be in the text. And he refers to Joseph Fielding Smith in that section, and certainly he did talk about Joseph Fielding and the different points of view when he was talking to the brethren. That was in January of 1931 to get approval. But certainly he didn't intend to have that in the text. So there are some differences, but basically we leave it to people. There are a few more questions. Oh, good. I haven't seen it. But tell us about it. What does it look like?
It's not got as many sort of different colors as yours. It's mostly light brown. I'm not advocating it. I just didn't know that.
Okay. Well, go.
Go. They're not a vote.
Okay.
So don't use the fact that it's got a dust jacket to make you think okay. that it's the
Okay, well then, good. Let's go look at them. I had nothing to do with this. I think it actually is kind of interesting how the face of B.H. Roberts, who it's his work. I'm just the editor. It's his work. All these are his words. There's his face, but notice centered in his brain is a picture of Jesus, who's, of course, the center of the whole text there. Yes, comment.
The question I have is what's good about B.B. Brown and what his feelings were about Joseph Fielding Smith. Are those things that you guessed, or that Ed Berman guessed, or what's the evidence
okay.
you have for that?
I didn't guess on it. I was told the day that I got the manuscript from Ed Firmage, he explained the context. I mean, he's a lawyer, and he knows that it's important to have a context and provenance of something, of a document or things. And he told me that and went through in detail, and I said, it would be very good. I would be much appreciated if you would put what you've said to me today in a letter. And so he did that. And so I'm quoting from the letter, and it's referred to in the book.
And
yes, that's right. Now, again, this is from Ed Firmage. We don't have anything firsthand from Hubie Brown. You remember that Ed Firmage was very, very close to his grandfather, and he went through a number of oral interview tapes, and eventually these came out as the memoirs of Hubie Brown. We have the text of that and the tapes at the University of Utah as part of the collection there. So that's the source, and I think it fits in with what we know elsewhere. Yes, I haven't heard that, but let me just review what I said earlier. That January of 1992 is when Ed Firmage contacted me actually late in December and said, I've got something that I want to do. We set up an appointment for early January, and that's when he gave it to us. Before that time, we had selected chapters here and there, some chapters of The Truth, the Way, the Life, that had been donated to the library. But we didn't have the whole text, and so that's the only time that we got the full text, and that would have to have reference to that. Ed Firmage, the day that I gave it to him, normally when we get stuff for the library, we just go get it, and then there's a period of time, and it's evaluated, and then after the evaluation, people sign a deed of gift. Well, knowing the importance of this, I took with me that day a deed of gift with his name and what he was going to be giving me. And as soon as he gave it to me, I gave him the deed of gift, 2 forms, one for him and one for me. He signed them both.
And so it became that day in his office, his ownership of that that he'd received from Hubie Brown transferred to the University of Utah. And so that's how we received that manuscript. Yes?
Stan, at the end of your presentation last year, I believe someone from the audience asked you the question, has this been copyrighted? And a couple of days later, if I recall, there was a notice, I believe, in the Morning Tribune about that issue. Would you comment on it, please?
Okay, I will. Let me just show you, just fresh from Benchmark Books. This is, it's really nice. I like it. This is how, before I came in this morning, that's how I saw the edition. And I think it's much improved. But you shouldn't judge either one of these by the cover. Go read it. Okay? But this is very good. It really is very good. I'm gonna leave it out for and in behalf of the BYU Studies team that didn't happen to be here. But there it is. It's a good edition. And now, you were asking about copyright. Yes, let me, anytime you want to talk, I'll turn it over to you.
I have nothing to say.
Well, I'll talk. I think you're going to say something, so we'll turn it over to you in just a minute. But let me talk about copyright just very briefly. There's been a couple of articles in the paper recently in different papers and discussing this. One of the things that we made a very careful and conscientious effort in the Smith Research Associates edition was to actually hire a competent lawyer to do research into the B.H. Roberts estate and his papers and the probate and all this kind of stuff, and came to the conclusion that since nothing specifically had been said in any of in his will or in the probate about the text or the papers of The Truth, The Way, The Life, this manuscript, being given to anyone in particular, a son, a daughter, a nephew, or the church, or anything like that, that therefore the conclusion from the legal counsel was that the copyright had descended to the heirs of B.H. Roberts. And it was with that understanding that we proceeded not to claim copyright. And also, by the way, in fairness to Ed Firmage, he's a lawyer, and he also made clear in a separate letter that when he was giving that manuscript to the University of Utah, he was not claiming copyright for it. He was claiming property rights to that manuscript, that particular manuscript that he was turning over. And he also said he neither was suggesting that it be published or suggesting that it not be published. He made no opinion on that. So that part was done. Now, the BYU Studies edition has proceeded on a different, different legal background. They approached the church to receive permission to publish this, and that was given to them. And the church also, part of this claim, they actually registered it with the Copyrights Office in Washington, D.C., as a work for hire, church claiming ownership, and that B.H. Roberts was someone, a work for hire. So they own the copyright. He was just sort of an employee doing that. The difficulty I see, and I'm on one side of that interpretation and the BYU Studies is on the other, and it'd be better if they were here to explain their position. It's in a couple of the essays in there. The problem I see is that all that correspondence, remember it's in the appendix over here, no one ever says, B.H. Roberts, what are you talking about? It's our book. You've got to do what we say. Never came up. It was simply, B.H. Roberts, would you please change your manuscript at these 20, 30, 40 points? He says no. He was unwilling to do that, although he didn't want to compromise what he felt was important. So in all the discussion at the time, in diaries and even things in this edition from the Council of the Quorum of the Twelve and the First Presidency, minutes that weren't available until this came out, talk about that same kind of thing. So it looks like there's two different interpretations. I haven't heard any kind of legal ramifications of that, and I don't expect to.
Then how did it get in the church archives?
It was donated with the B.H. Roberts Library, and that's part of this probate stuff. The whole library of his printed books in which he put marginal comments and so forth, this was one of the manuscripts that went there, but it wasn't specifically mentioned. And even if it were, suppose that it really were in the family that donated it to the church, actually said, we give up all copyright for it and give it to them, it still wouldn't have change the situation in the sense that there's actually two, that Beatrice Roberts was polygamous with three wives. The third was a post-manifesto polygamy wife. There were no children. But the first two were in polygamy, and he had children by both sides. So even if one side gave up their copyright to the church, the other side could publish. You just have to share with both sides of the family. That's why what we're doing here is any of the proceeds, the normal royalties to an author, or in this case an editor, and the different essays in there, none of that is going to them. It's all going to one family wants it to the B.H. Roberts Society, the royalties. The other side of the family, their half goes to the B.H. Roberts organization in Centerville. So that's how those things are going. Now, I think before we do any more questions, we ought to turn the time over to Van Hale. We're not quite talking about what we're supposed to as the panel, but we're just taking things as they come here. So turn the time over to Van.
Well, now I have the chance to ask you some more questions about this, I guess. back in the, it's a long, long way back, but back in the 1960s, I was a young missionary in Northern California, and I discovered from a companion's a little technique that was very effective, seemed very effective, and that technique was that when you get in some discussion with the other missionaries or with some more intelligent investigator to the church, you could ask three questions, and particularly if you asked them with the right tone of voice and made it sound like what you were about to made it sound like you were an intelligent individual with something important to say and had some good answers. The three questions that are three that you've all heard many times, and that is, where did we come from? Why are we here, and where are we going? I mean, that lifts our minds up to the kind of the loftier realms and into the area of careful thought and intelligence. Well, in regards to the book, I was thinking maybe I would do the same thing. Where did it come from? Why is it here, and where is it going? Stan's been talking about where did it come from, and the interesting title of our panel discussion indicates that we were, I guess, supposed to be speculating as to what would have happened had it been published and what is going to happen now that it has been published. My particular interest in the truth, the way, and the life is the theological innovations of B.H. Roberts and the additions that he made to the development of LDS doctrine and theology. And I don't have any idea, Rudy, as to what impact the book may have on LDS thinking in the future. It may have a great impact, it may not. Stan and I were talking on the radio a month or two ago, and I think it was during a commercial or something. I don't think this went over the air, but he was talking about the fact that it hasn't been published for all these years. All of a sudden, two editions come out. There are going to be some discussions and symposiums and things for a short time, and people will just very carefully put these on their shelves, and they'll be lost and forgotten. And that might happen. I don't know. But I think a great deal has to do with where the church is going, and I don't know I don't know the answer to that either. But as we look at situations that surrounded the publication of, or not the publication, but the writing of B.H. Roberts' manuscript, and the issues that were controversial, the issues upon which B.H. Roberts had individuals who, in the First Presidency and so forth, who were taking exception with some of his ideas or were concerned or felt some were too speculative. As we look at those situations, we see that Brigham H. Roberts had a significant impact upon Mormon theology and Mormon thinking. Two of the theologically, one of the most important questions, I believe, that needs to be answered is the question of are we going to approach God as an absolute being or as a finite being? And we haven't sorted these things out yet as a church. We don't have, I don't believe, an established theology in a lot of these areas. For example, we look back just briefly at the very influential Bruce R. McConkie, and his thinking and his ideas seem to move very much, in my mind, toward the direction of the Protestant reformers, much in that direction, and much in the direction of more traditional Christian theology. He seemed to be an advocate of the idea that God is absolute, he's omniscient, he's omnipresent, in the same sort of sense that Protestant reformers may refer to this. One of the very important areas that B.H. Roberts addressed, and in fact I consider this to be his doctrine, was the B.H. Roberts doctrine of the preexistence. He came up with an innovation in regards to man's preexistence, which has been very effective. And his view was, as presented in The Truth, the Way, and the Life, as well as many other portions of his writing, his presentation, his doctrine, I haven't been able to find any place where this was taught prior to B.H. Roberts. I can't find an advocate prior to him in this area. But his idea was that man existed from all eternity as an intelligence. And as he defines intelligence, maybe I can just open this up and read it to you if I've got it here. He says the difference between intelligence, between spirits and intelligences, as herein used, is this. Intelligences are uncreated entities, some inhabiting spiritual bodies, bodies composed of fine spirit elements. Others are intelligences unembodied in either spirit bodies or other kinds of bodies. So he makes this distinction between the intelligence of man and the spirit of man. And he proceeds in his thinking to indicate that what happened is that this intelligence, which he identifies as a conscious entity, an entity capable of making moral judgment, of thinking, and so forth, was in a premortal birth, was clothed with a spirit body, as the LDS view of spirit bodies being clothed in the physical body on this earth. That analogy was drawn. And that particular idea, I was surprised to find, was an innovation of B.H. Roberts. I grew up with that idea. I was born here in the Valley, raised in Salt Lake City. And I have thought back many times as I have thought about this whole topic over the years. Because you go back to Brigham Young, you can't find this doctrine. You go back to Joseph Smith, it's not there either. It started with Brigham Young, as we see Brigham Young's ideas, but and on this particular idea, this was a controversial idea that he had been asked by the First Presidency to delete from some of his writings, which he did sometimes, and other times he didn't. But I just out of a matter of interest, I've thought back and I've tried to decide where did I get this idea from. Did it come from my parents? Did I get it in Sunday school? Was it something I read? Because before I became at all interested in study of Mormon history and doctrine, I already had this idea. I don't know. I'm just wondering, did anybody else grow up with this idea? Where did it come from? How many who are from an LDS background, grew up with the idea that we started as an intelligence, we were clothed in the spirit, and then we're clothed in the physical body?
I got it in seminary.
Seminary?
Yeah, I That's too recent.
Yeah, it did come out in Nelson's Scientific Aspects of Mormonism in 1904. It's very clearly stated in
Well, and there—I mean, there are all kinds of places to find it. It's in B.H. Roberts' writings, in his dealing with his extensive footnote on the King Follett discourse, and throughout his writings, Widsoe talks about it, Talmage, so forth. But where did I get this from? In Sunday school and priesthood meeting, and I don't know, but somehow. Somehow this concept of B.H. Roberts, which was not looked upon favorably, let me just mention what the two ideas were, as I see it, that preceded that. What B.H. Roberts inherited doctrinally in the church was he inherited the teachings of Brigham Young and virtually everybody at the turn of the century seems to me, from my studies, to have been pretty much of one mind, although there were some differences, and Brigham Young and Orson Pratt argued over these differences, but it seemed like they were in harmony on this idea, and that is that matter's eternal, the spirit's eternal, was never created, will never be destroyed, but that the spirit as we know it, or the spirit as we think about, as they thought about it in LDS theology, the spirit which enters the body, had a point, there was a point in time when that spirit came into that particular form, and that was at a premortal spirit birth. And in this premortal spirit, prior to the premortal spirit birth, both Brigham Young and Orson Pratt, although they differed upon what the substance was, there was a natural element. And the spirits were created in this premortal birth out of this spirit element. But prior to that, the individual had no conscious, was not a conscious entity. It seems to me from a number of clear references from Joseph Smith that the position that he took, his view was that the spirit of conscious entity had existed from all eternity, and that God organized these spirits in the pre-existence, did not give birth to them, but organized them. Now, I'm not absolutely certain on this, and I'm probably not going to have time to go into the pluses and minuses or the controversy over what Joseph Smith actually believed. I think it can be argued in two different directions, but I think the predominance of evidence was that Joseph Smith did not believe in a premortal spirit birth, but that the spirits were uncreated, and have existed from all eternity. So B.H. Roberts was faced with these two ideas, the eternity of the spirit and the idea of premortal spirit birth. And what he did, and he found his justification in the King Follett discourse, not in the King Follett discourse itself, but in a flawed amalgamation of the King Follett discourse, which had a peculiar phrase in there two times, the phrase intelligence of spirits. And Stan and I worked jointly on a project on this some years ago, and Stan put together a new amalgamated text of the King Follett discourse, which is a very fine, accurate representation of what the manuscripts of that discourse are. But in the amalgamation that was put together in 1855 by the church historians here in Salt Lake City, a peculiarity entered into the text, namely the phrase, the intelligence of the spirit, and that appears in the text two times, but it is not in any of the reports of the text, and I think it was something that didn't mean a whole lot until B.H. Roberts picked up on it, and he built his whole argument, or his whole idea, I believe, on that particular phrase in the King Follett discourse, that there is an intelligence of spirit, and so the intelligence comes first, and then and that's a portion, only a portion of the Spirit. So significant aspect of all of this in my mind is that B.H. Roberts brought together in synthesis the idea of Joseph Smith, which has a great deal of appeal from a theological standpoint. The theological that Joseph Smith was teaching that there is an aspect of man, a conscious entity. B.H. Roberts expands upon this idea that has the capacity of making moral judgment that is uncreated. And so what that does in theology is it takes away from God the possible charge that God is the author of evil. And that in theological fields is has been one of the great problems. If God is the creator of everything, if he created everything out of nothing, then if you follow this through logically, you end up having God being the author, the creator and author of evil. B.H. Roberts in his book speaks out very strongly against this and sees this as one of the great strengths of Mormonism, of Mormon theology, is that we are not placing God responsible for the evil in man or the evil in the world. And so that was one of the contributions that I believe B.H. Roberts brought back, because the idea that Joseph Smith had advanced was an idea that I think had disappeared in Mormon thinking. Yes, throughout the time from 1844 on to the time of B.H. Roberts to the turn of the century, the idea was around and was strongly advocated that the spirit of man is eternal, but not eternal as a conscious entity. And so therefore, B.H. Roberts, I think, brought back this idea of Joseph Smith, and he synthesized that with the ideas of Brigham Young and the very popular idea that had gained almost universal acceptance in Mormonism, that the spirit came about in the preexistence from a premortal birth. So he brought these two ideas together and has allowed for an idea which I think, I don't know, it's certainly not, I would certainly not suggest that it's Mormon doctrine at this point, but I would certainly think that it's an idea which has a large number of individuals that believe it. Yes?
For 30 years, and I won't bore you with names, much of the philosophical world has in effect shown the extremely limited and very partial and biased character of that old Enlightenment rational theology move across a whole wide range of human experience and discourse. And, you know, the names come from the continent. There are Americans involved in this movement. It seems to me we ought to be less certain today that old, you know, Witzo, Talmadge sort of rational theology framework is going to hold water anymore. It just may not do it.
Let me read one little thing here that would maybe help out on this point somewhat. The real opponent that B.H. Roberts had on this idea was, it appears, was Charles W. Penrose, who was in the First Presidency at the time with Anthon Lund. And I'm a direct descendant of Charles W. Penrose, and so I suppose I have to take his side in this matter, but I actually like B.H. Roberts better, this point better. But in 1911 was a critical year in all of this. Several things were happening. The history of the church that he was editing was about to be published, which was going to contain the King Follett Discourse. That B.H. Roberts, I mean, that was, he spoke so highly of that. I would think that appears to be probably his favorite piece of literature in all of written literature, from the way he writes about it. So that he was editing that volume of the history of the church at that time. He was also writing an article, a serial article that the church was very interested in because it was being published in a national magazine called The Americana. He was working on Chapter 55 of the History of the Mormon Church was the title of the articles, series of articles. and this was being published in the Americana magazine, a historical magazine published by the National Americana Society in New York. And this chapter was entitled The Prophet's Work, Mormonism, A System of Philosophy, and was devoted to a discussion of Joseph Smith's philosophical and theological beliefs. This chapter was reviewed and amended by President Joseph S. Smith's two counselors, Anthony H. Lund and Charles W. Penrose. In his diary of 25 August 1911, President Lund observed, he says this, "Today we had Brother Roberts read his article on the philosophy of the prophet Joseph Smith. Brother Penrose made a splendid speech on eternalism, opposing the view of Brother B. Roberts, who holds that the intelligences were self-existent entities before they entered into the organization of spirit." And then again on the 29th of August, again from Lund's diary, he says, "I spent the forenoon in the historian's office where Brother C.W. Penrose and I listened to Brother Roberts read his concluding chapter on the prophet Joseph Smith. We got him to eliminate his theories in regard to intelligences as conscious self-existing beings or entities before being organized into spirits. His doctrine has raised much discussion, and the inference on which he builds his theory is very vague. The prophet's speech delivered as a funeral sermon over King Follett is the basis of Brother Robert's doctrine, namely, where he speaks of man's eternity claim. Roberts wants to prove that man, then, is coeval with God. He no doubt felt bad to have us eliminate his pet theory." So this was a theory that B.H. Roberts was advancing. He was running into some objection from the First Presidency on this. But what happened, in fact, was that B.H. Roberts outlived Charles W. Penrose by a few years. And when he reprinted these articles from the Americana magazine that had this idea in it as the comprehensive history of the church in 1930, he put this back in because those that objected to it were then gone. Yes.
Well, I'll talk a little bit about that specifically and then in general, but this what-if speculation. Actually, I think James Allen has done a pretty good job in surveying the historical development of the controversy. Whenever he talks about Josephine Smith, I notice there's like an epithet or an appositive saying how wonderful this general authority was. That kind of thing I thought was unnecessary. He didn't give B.H. Roberts, who was also a general authority, the same kind of coverage. But then that's up to him to write the article the way he wants. But the valuable thing is that he had access to what's referred in his footnotes as the TWL collection, the Truth, the Way, the Life collection, a special collection extracted from various church archives documents that he was quoting from. And these are things that were completely unavailable to me or to anyone else up until the time that his article came out. So in that sense, there's more information. What I find in that more information confirms what I'd seen before. B.H. Roberts actually said not just 6 weeks before he died, but several times during this controversy, he said, "If you don't accept the manuscript of the Truth, the Way, the Life, I'll publish it on my own." I thought he only did that at the end in August of 1933. But there are several times when he kind of warned them, if they don't approve it, he's going to do it on his own. The statement that we have at the very end is in the Wesley P. Lloyd diary, that a copy of which is now at the University of Utah. He tells Wesley Lloyd about some other things, but specifically about the Truth, the Way, the Life. B.H. Roberts says he finally decided to publish it on his own. This is August 1933. And there was only one thing holding him back, not the trouble with the brethren, not that he might lose his place as president of the First Council of 70, or even something worse could happen, but rather the one thing that was holding his back was the lack of funds. He just didn't have the money to do it. And it turns out 6 weeks later he passed away with this unpublished manuscript. So that's kind of the situation. I think it's valuable to have these documents. I talked after it came out. I called Jim Allen on the phone and told him that it was a good article. And I said, how about that thing you refer to in the footnotes, the TWL collection? And he said he couldn't let me see it, but that Jack Welch has the copy and he's going to decide whether to give it to BYU Library or what. So we'll have to wait and see. That would be nice to have those documents firsthand. For just a second, I don't like to do this this kind of speculation about what might have been, but it's kind of been, a couple people have mentioned this, and I would like to say from my own experience in growing up in the church, what I think the publication of B.H. Roberts' manuscript as a book back in the 1930s would have done a little bit differently for me, because I grew up only knowing, I mean, I was just an innocent little kid. I'm not quite so innocent now, but nor so little. But I accepted everything that was told to me. I never for a minute thought that my parents or any of my teachers in Sunday school and primary and finally Aaronic priesthood would say anything different than what it should be. And I didn't really, I knew of nothing but sort of what I was taught. Then it happened one day, and I remember it. I was a deacon in a deacon's quorum, and my teacher, he's still alive in Boise, Idaho. He was teaching the Aaronic priesthood for the deacons, the Aaronic priesthood lesson from the manual. And he said, and I had never in my life, see, I was about 12 or 13, I suppose, heard this before. He had the manual. It was, you know, about that thick, which we'd been using all these years, that you know, different manuals. And he said, I want to tell you, you boys, that I don't agree with what's in the manual. Now, maybe that's not such a big deal to you, but I couldn't believe it. He said it was about, I think it was about Oscar W. McConkie's book on the Holy Ghost is what we were using. He said, I just don't agree. I don't remember exactly what the disagreement was. Someday I'll have to go back and find out what manual it was and read whatever Oscar W. McConkie had and then postulate what the other thing was. But he said, I disagree with what the author in this manual is saying. I want to tell you what I think it should be. And then he told us, it's something about the Holy Ghost. Don't know any more about it. I've forgotten the content, but the effect of that statement on me was astounding. It wasn't, I didn't tell my parents about it, but it was a startling thing to have a teacher say, something in the church manual is wrong. Now, to me, that was a milestone in my life as a little 13-year-old kid. Now, what I'm saying about this is that I also grew up and learned and read about the Joseph Fielding Smith, Man, His Origin and Destiny. I didn't know. I had no idea that there was another point of view earlier in the 1930s with B.H. Roberts, kind of what you're saying there. And I think if it had come out, and let's say Joseph Fielding had his right perfectly, that's fine, get both points of view out, I think there would have been a better balance in terms of, yes, general authorities can actually have an opinion different from another general authority. And what that means is that those are in the peripheral areas that aren't the central core of the gospel, and you would have had a better understanding of what is essential and what, rather than just taking everything in the whole world is the gospel doctrine straight down the line, you have differences of opinion. I think it would have been a more mellowing and a more balanced point of view if that had come about. So that's my little speculation on what might have been, speaking from my own personal experience. And see, that helped you because you were in a position to wonder or know about things, wrote a letter and got a letter back, but that letter didn't become public, and that knowledge of the other point of view didn't become public. That, to me, is the unbalanced situation I see finally being not just fulfilled, but doubly fulfilled. Look, we have two editions.
Yes.
Ben, have you checked on or was into that area, even though, as you said, I think you've shown that in your article, that those that did teach, as you said.
Let me just quickly go back. There are a number of statements that are primary statements from good sources, diaries, and sermons of Joseph Smith reported at the time that present the idea that the spirit he didn't, I don't believe Joseph Smith made the distinction between the spirit and intelligence that B.H. Roberts thinks he sees in the King Follett discourse. However, this is the problem that I find myself in, why I would hesitate being absolutely certain on this, and that is that at the death of Joseph Smith, I mean the day Joseph Smith was killed, June 27th, while I'm turning the page here, an item was advertised for sale in the church periodical by Orson Pratt. And this item was the Prophetic Almanac for 1845. And he was publishing this almanac to be available for the next year. In this, so he had to have produced this before Joseph Smith was killed. And he was obviously an associate of Joseph Smith's. How close, it's maybe hard to say. But he was also, as we know from later years, Orson Pratt was a devoted disciple of Joseph Smith. And he publishes this item, and in this he has a little portion entitled The Mormon Creed. Now, so he's not just presenting his idea here, doesn't seem to me. He's presenting in this almanac something which he calls the Mormon Creed. And this is what he says. What is man? The offspring of God. What is God? The father of man. Who is Jesus Christ? He is our brother. How many states of existence has man? He has three. What is the first? It is spiritual. What is the second? It is temporal. What is the third? It is immortal and eternal. How did he begin to exist in the first? He was begotten and born of God. How did he begin to exist in the second? He was begotten and born of the flesh. So we've got this statement. I have a letter by Lorenzo Snow, a very speculative letter that he's writing to another missionary in England in 1842, in which he's advancing this idea that there was a spirit birth in the premortal existence. So the idea is around at Joseph Smith's time, and it's not only around, but it's around with people that are close to him. Right shortly after his death, William Phelps in the John Taylor publishes an item in the Times and Seasons that advocates the spirit birth in the pre-mortal existence. William Phelps presents the same idea. Orson Pratt presents it again in a funeral address, and Eliza R. Snow published it in the poem My Father in Heaven, which we know as Oh My Father, in which she also indicates that same idea. So the problem that I have is how is it if Joseph Smith held a view that didn't allow for that, which I think his direct statements don't allow for the idea of a premortal birth, how are all these people who are so close to him and whom I think are not going to advance as Mormon creed a doctrinal innovation that was opposed to Joseph Smith, how is this happening? And my answer to that is I simply don't know, but it may well be that Joseph Smith had did have an idea that maybe I'm wrong on how maybe he believed that there was a premortal spirit birth and somehow he worked this in with the idea, with this other idea of the spirit being eternal. Well, maybe B.H. Roberts was right. Maybe this would... Hey, he was right. Figured it out.
I have a question for Stan Larson. I heard your speech last year, and I was excited for when the book came out, and I heard it come out in the Mormon History Association. So I went to a bookstore in Provo, and I picked up the green one. I had no idea that there were two versions until after I'd gotten home and realized, because it mentioned, I don't know if it mentions or someone told me anyway. As I was reading through the prefaces, it mentions that it is a work from the third manuscript, but it mentions that there were two other manuscripts, and I've gotten about halfway through it. I'm not reading it necessarily in order. I'm looking at the chapters that interest me. And it has a whole bunch of references in there too. This was what he wrote in the first manuscript, and that it was later changed to this or whatever. And I'm wondering if you also had access to those other two manuscripts, or if the third manuscript is the one that you're talking about that Ed Burmidge had.
Yes, that's a good question. And all we had that we got from Ed Burmidge, from his grandfather, Hubie Brown, was the manuscript number 3. Drafts 1 and 2, or manuscript 1 and 2, during the whole time of working on this, were unavailable, and they still remain unavailable at the church archives. But BYU Studies Edition, to their credit, have a separate publication, a facsimile reprint of all three of those manuscripts, so you can now see them. As it turns out, it wasn't an appreciable loss, because the first two manuscripts, there's only about one footnote that has a significant reading from manuscript 1 or 2, and it's simply a statement he made that he decided not to use. It's not really that
earth-shattering. So the main manuscript on both of these that they rely upon is manuscript number 3. And so there's not really that much of a loss. The other thing, I should say this in credit to the church archives, though I asked a number of times to see the B.H. Roberts collection and was denied, and also to see the Truth, the Way, the Life and was denied. I guess you were allowed to back in the 70s and has an article that was published based on the fact that it was available, and I wish those good days would come back again. But at any rate, remember what we had at the Marriott Library was a photocopy. And it happens that in one of these pages it's been referred to how B.H. Roberts might add a little note. Well, in one of these, at the bottom of the page, you could see the note added and it was pinned onto the page, and yet the footnote showed that there were some footnotes under that. For the photocopy, can't see under it. So I made a request to see one page of The Truth, the Way, the Life. That particular page. And I was allowed to. I was very pleased, and I gave them credit. We give them proper credit in the Smith Research for seeing one page. Really, it was quite interesting. It was exciting to me. The first time, and so far the only time, that I've actually seen it. And there, what looked like just lines on the photocopy was actually the red typewriter. You know, they had those typewriters would have on the ribbon the black and the red parts. So parts of it were in red, which was kind of an exciting little, not too important, but it kind of exciting to see that. But what I did is I lifted up that sheet, and sure, there was actually text under there, not just the footnote references, which I could guess, but there was a text. So I gave that text, carefully transcribed it, and printed that with a proper notation that this came from the church archive. So I was very happy about that and must give them credit for being allowed to see one page. Yes. Well, it's a closed collection. It's a closed collection. And another thing about it, you can see in the bibliographies on both books, it shows the library of B.H. Roberts and the books that he was referring to. It would have been valuable, and I think more than valuable, it would have been appropriate to include perhaps some of these notes. See, B.H. Roberts quoted from different things, but he also put his notes in the margin, and it would be nice to be able to see those actual books, but that's unavailable. Claire?
Back to the idea of the impact of this new release or new releases of these editions. And I would be interested if you or anyone would like to comment about the potential impact in the context of the impact of earlier B.H. Roberts' edition of Studies of the Book of Mormon, which has been out now several years. Different subjects, same author.
Yes, you're referring to the edition that was published 1985, University of Illinois Press, called the Studies of the Book of Mormon. It's interesting. Here we are talking about B.H. Roberts, and there was actually then two manuscripts unpublished at his death. This Truth, the Way, the Life, having just come out this year. And the other thing, before I comment on those two, the circumstances of the manuscripts is a little bit differently. It happens that the Truth, the Way, the Life manuscript, the three drafts of it, were all given later that year, 1933, by the family and with B.H. Roberts Library to the church. So they had the only copy of The Truth, the Way, the Life. On the Book of Mormon studies, if you read that, there's like two manuscript studies and then one thing done a few years later called a parallel that became public first. Those two manuscripts, one was presented to the brethren, the other was written by B.H. Roberts, who felt that he just hadn't really tackled the problem of the origin of the Book of Mormon and produced several hundred page study. That was never presented to the brethren. That manuscript stayed in the possession of his family and then later with other documents was donated to the University of Utah. So they've both been published. Now, again, I'm not a prophet and I don't often predict the future, but it was already referred on the radio. It may have been in our discussion during a commercial, it may have been on the radio, I don't know either. But I made the statement, and I'll say it again today publicly, that I think that now that we have these two, people can look at them and learn a lot from them, and I think there's a lot to learn. I think there's a lot of church theology that you may agree or not agree with, but there's a lot of stuff to go to. But I see that 10 years from now, these editions will be nicely tucked away on shelves at home and on library shelves, will be available for reference. People that want to look at it, they can, and that will be the end of it. But the other part of this prophecy is what you've come up with, and I think that 50 years from now, B.H. Roberts' study, these three different manuscript studies that were published by the University of Illinois, now it's in paperback by Signature Books, will be in print, will be read, and be startling to young generations that come up on the Book of Mormon, and will be a focus for them to understand what people seem to say B.H. Roberts, and I certainly agree with it, that he's the greatest intellectual that we've had in the church, and a general authority, as well as an intellectual, has said those things and offered those ideas. I think that's going to have effect later, whereas this won't be.
Okay. Let me give a little prophecy, too. I'm going to prophesy on the other side. I think what has happened traditionally throughout Christian history and LDS history, and what we're seeing, what happened in at the turn of the century with B.H. Roberts on a number of different points, is that you have somebody who has a very strong advocate of an idea, who's capable of presenting this idea in a forceful manner, and then you have others who don't like the idea, so you have the controversy. And I think, for example, if there hadn't been this sort of a situation back in the early centuries of Christianity, the doctrine of the Trinity would have never become a doctrine. It was the strong controversy, people on strong minds on both sides of the issue. And so, what my prediction is in regards to the truth, the way, and the life, is that There will arise a disciple of B.H. Roberts who will get into this material and become a very strong advocate of this, and will find some resistance somewhere within the church, and there will be a controversy, and this will force the issue of our theology. What we really need to get this going is just a real good, strong, solid heretic. Anyone want to volunteer? Okay, we've got one volunteer here. Actually, I think with the situation that we're in the church right now is what we really need for some of these ideas. I'm very fond of the theological ideas in B.H. Roberts, and I don't know what's true and what isn't. I know what I prefer and what I don't prefer, but I think what we really need at this point in the church, I don't think a heretic's going to do a whole lot of good. We need, I think, some individuals that are well respected within the upper echelons of the church who have a strong difference of opinion over some of these issues. Is man eternal? Is God absolute? Is God finite? And these issues need to be have a respected disciple or opposing disciples for this issue to get moved on. Yes.
I wouldn't offer a prophecy, but I'd offer some hope. I hope in 10 or 20 years we look back on this book and say, gosh, even in a sanitized version, this would have been a very exciting priesthood manual. Because it's more exciting than anything that I've seen in the church since Correlation has come along.
In the back.
Amazing to me that our people, when we were in agrarian society, were talking about these kinds of things at the turn of the century, and now it's all practical.
Take the hand in the back.
I'd be interested in knowing what year did P.H. Roberts die? What was his frame of mind in his later years? What was he doing? And was he struggling to put horses?
He was. He died in 1933. He had been in failing health, had a number of health problems, diabetes. And that was probably the major one that had affected his eyesight and some other things. He was not really a well man for several years, but he wanted this work published. And it's not at all clear that in the case of the studies of the Book of Mormon, he had ever had those kinds of dreams for that work that he had for this one. That was more for his private study and reflection. He may have gotten around to publishing it later, but I've never seen any indication in Robert's record that he was expecting that to be published or really wanted that to be published. Because he didn't like to publish things until they were ready. And until he thought he had the problem solved. And on that one, he hadn't solved the problem. Other hand?
It seems to me that this issue will have no impact on the church because 99% of the church members don't care. That is, it's only the intellectual community that will worry about whether God is absolute or finite, whether God can be a loving God, whether he's a Christ, whether he's the author of evil. Who cares?
Yeah. Well, no. Let me second what you're saying to make my own sort of prophecy. I'll do this by coming at it kind of sideways. One of the three or four greatest philosophers of the 18th century is the great Frenchman Rousseau. Rousseau always styled himself, and a lot of his work, he didn't sign his name to him, he just put a citizen of Geneva. And there's a footnote to his greatest work, Social Contract, where he says, Calvin, who was essentially both a religious and political founder of Geneva, says, whatever Calvin's merits as a theologian, he will always be remembered as a first-class political leader. And Rousseau was, in a sense, making a comparison or a contrast between something like the Institutes of the Christian Religion, which is really the theological masterpiece of the Reformation, I think just has to be. Luther was more in the mold of an Augustine, writing occasional pieces, lectures on Scripture, books on the Bible, I mean, lectures and amplifications of biblical texts and materials. But if you're looking for a systematic working out of one version of Reformation doctrine, logically drawn out rigorously by a man trained in the classics and in law, with this kind of rigorous exposition of doctrines laid out and correlated and everything, the kind of thing that Roberts is in a way trying to do here, you know, fitting all the pieces of the puzzle together in a sort of rational whole, Calvin's your man. Calvin was also a political leader of a community, Geneva. And a community that Rousseau, in a way, preferred, or at least professed to prefer, and one can debate the precise connections. But in a way, Mormonism is, I think, most fundamentally grounded in the development of a community, the building of a community. And for the building of community, a systematic working out of doctrine is less important to the lived experience of the community than other elements are, other points are, other, not, I don't want to say doctrines, but a theology that arises out of the lived experience of the community. Furthermore, if you look at the religious communities that are growing and thriving and speaking to the soul of their members, they aren't the religious communities that are particularly enamored of the theology of Tillich or Bultmann or other post-Enlightenment thinkers. And so I wonder whether this will have an impact insofar as we are that kind of community. And I'm, first of all, wonder whether we would want it that way, because those are the communities that seem to speak to the intellectuals and forget the lived experience of the ordinary person in the community. And I think, if I have to pick between which side I'm going to go, the Institutes of the Christian Religion or lived experience of Calvinist Geneva, I'll pick the lived experience of Calvinist Geneva every time out.
Comment on that, being intellectual requires a lot of hard work, a lot of study, and most people are lazy, and most people will not put forth the effort to be intellectual to understand what these issues really
even are. That's the reason why intellectualism will fail.
I wouldn't say lazy.
If they are lazy.
No, that's not a word I would use. I wouldn't use lazy. I would use looking at their priorities. Most people's... But if you're looking at the people who have a great investment, invest a lot of time in the community, what are they investing their time in? It's community building activities. It isn't reading and discussing theology. And it seems to me they've got their priorities just right on that one. Yes?
Part of the lived experience of the community is what happens when you use your own intuition, use your own intelligence, try to enter into discussions with people. And if we have books like this that show that some people are actually using their intelligence and speaking up and things like that, it can enrich our trust and the ability to do that. I don't know how to say this, but part of the lived experience of the community today is with very, very limited ability to exercise our own insights and to express them. And to the extent that if this had been published earlier and we believed less in the fetish of unanimity, if we'd had a little bit more place for free and open discussion, the experience of the lived community would be richer and freer for a whole lot of us.
I don't think that's a good definition of community. Yeah.
You don't think when you say it, when you speak up in church meetings?
I'm not fully convinced of this pluralistic community. My friend Bill Martin back there is probably going to correct me on this. But.
Well, yeah, I mean, I wanted to agree with what he was saying, because the Mormons are, in a sense, a very special kind of community, in the sense that they're not exactly a traditional community in the sense of being pre-secular, but one that arose on the margins or the periphery of secular society. And therefore, the consciousness, or you know, what we call now intentional, this whole idea of intentional community, which doesn't play such a role in traditional community. Well, then, why is it there more of an? I mostly agree with what you're saying, actually, in terms of the lived experience. But isn't there a greater role for getting the intentions together, so to speak? In other words, getting together the consciousness of what this community project is about, and then wouldn't works such as Roberts.
It might. I still would remain unconvinced. What is our time frame? Are we
1 minute?
Then we will take one question over here. Someone who hasn't spoken.
Well, yeah, I wonder if you haven't drawn the distinction much too sharply. I mean, I live in North Carolina, and now I'm Baptist. One of the big discussions people get in is one saved, all is saved, and that goes back to the those kind of, you know, nobody believes in Christianism, but it had an impact on the way that the American Protestants think. And same thing with us. I mean, well, we don't get into heavy theological discussions in priesthood meetings. We do it at Father and Son's outing, or go around the table on Saturday night, or something like that. And those discussions do happen. Now, I think, I don't want to draw my disagreement too sharply, because I think theological reflection happens actually is something you have both logically and historically after religious experience. But I do think it's important. People think about what it is they believe.
Yeah, I think you're right. I would make one final comment. I think that it is very helpful to have this out. I really admire having this out. For one reason is that though I think you can show that almost all of this was already out, it wasn't in one place. I mean, if you wanted to look for it, you had to look in at various other sources and places around. And this is a book to be kept on the shelf and referred to often. I think we're at time. Thank you.